Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Msingi Talks podcast, a podcast hosted by Msingi Trust. We are very honored to be doing this Faith and Feminism series, a series sponsored by Voice. I'm very, very excited to have an amazing guest here to talk about all things faith, feminism, and freedom. Joanne, wouldn't you introduce yourself?
Thank you, Carol. I'm happy to be here. My name is Joanne Kuria. I'm passionate about this conversation on faith and feminism and figuring out, do they merge, do they contradict, and all of that stuff. I am a policy and comms specialist, and I work in the INGO space.
All right.
Yes, and I sit on the board of Msingi Trust.
Yes, she is a board member at Msingi Trust, so yeah. We have cool people at Msingi. So. All right. So before we get to the meat of this conversation, it's good to know a little bit about you.
Yeah.
I love asking this question on all our podcasts.
Yeah.
What brings you great joy?
Wow. Currently the Nairobi weather.
This heat.
During the day. Like I like how it's sunny. It just gives you room to do a lot of things, but at night it's really hot. That's another thing altogether. Mm-hmm. I think what brings me joy generally is justice. I know that sounds like high up in the clouds, but I can't explain what happens to me when I witness something that is just, you know, something that we've been waiting for, that, you know, a court has ruled on, or I don't know, just a life being changed. That gives me a lot of joy. And I'm also a nerd and I love books, so books give me a lot of joy as well.
All right.
So yeah, my kids give me a lot of joy. Yeah, that's what top of mind I can say.
Top of your list. Yeah. The joy bringers.
Yes, joy bringers. I like that.
Yes. What brings you sorrow?
Ah, such deep questions. Yes. What brings me sorrow? So there's a Maasai guy on my street where I live who had been selling newspapers for the past 15 years. And just yesterday, he was run down by a matatu.
No.
And I found out today morning that he died.
Ah.
Yeah. He's a very, I mean, he's almost like a permanent fixture on that road. And now it just feels, so I passed by there coming for this recording, and I was like, oh my gosh, he's not there anymore. Yet he's been there for 15 years. So I think such things just really bring the depths of sorrows for me, for sure.
I think when I think about that, I just think of the way life is so fickle.
It is.
But then also this life, this, especially with Kenya and class issues and all of that, there's some lives in Kenya that
matter more.
That matter more. And him, he will be forgotten in a while, unfortunately, by the system.
Yeah.
And the person who ran them over will continue going on with their lives. Pole sana about that.
Thank you.
Pole.
Thank you.
So this conversation is about faith, feminism, and freedom, which most times seem like two very antithetical points of departure.
Yeah.
Where did you, is there a place, can you recall, when did you say, most of us know when we say that I am a Christian, I think, but I'm a feminist. When what brought about that?
To be honest, I can't remember when. I can't remember if it was like a day, a month, or a year.
Yeah.
But I remember feeling things even before I could put words to the feelings that I had. So when I was in primary school, I remember incidences when I was really vocal. I was a really noisy child in my class.
Yeah.
And my dad was called several times. Hi, McKinney Primary School. called several times because I was super vocal. I was always on, like, people would coalesce around me because I had so many stories. I remember one day being punished because I had a story about Hitler and the Nazi regime, and I was probably like nine years or something like that. And the teacher who punished me just even said, this is not decorum that women should have, like girls should have. Like,
wow.
On top of, like, you're noisy and then you're a girl, like, how? Like, just chill, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like that completely unsettled my spirit. And now when I look back, I think that I was pushing back because I felt that this was a woman who was trying to stifle
a young girl. Oh, it was a woman.
Yes.
Oh, you know, in my in my head, I immediately thought it was a man.
No, it was a woman, it was a female teacher who was trying to stifle me because of some notions and perceptions that she holds.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't explain at the time, but I was, my spirit just roared, like in anger.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's some of these small situations and nuggets that I feel like I've experienced throughout my life that just sort of like just, you know, brought something, you know, in the pit of your stomach that was unsettling.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a day for me. It wasn't a month or a year or a season.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was accumulation of small things that pointed me to what's Acme about the life that we live.
Yes.
How it's constructed.
Yeah.
And potentially what I can do to change that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do you think that most of us have that? You know that thing you said,
yeah.
like a thing
yeah.
inside
yeah.
here?
Yeah.
Do you think many of us have that about injustice, but then we don't know how to talk about it or it's
yeah.
silenced?
Yeah.
How are you able to identify that
yeah.
and then also find your voice in that conversation?
Yeah. I think for me, because of being a Christian and being in spaces that encouraged you to find what is God's purpose for your life, I was very cognizant of, is that it? Is that it? Is that my purpose? Like, you're constantly looking and finding out what that is.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that brings me sorrow,
yeah.
which I should have said at the beginning,
yes.
is the notion of living to die.
So
you're granted maybe 7 to 75 years.
Yes.
You're on this earth, then you just vanish.
Mm.
That is something that's, it's so damning, right? And I don't want to be like that. I don't want to have to live a life just to die.
Yes.
And so my constant question over time has been, why am I here? Why am I here? Mm. What can I do? And I think we all have a nagging feeling.
Mm-hmm.
We all have a nagging feeling that's in the pit of our stomach that manifests in different ways.
Yeah.
That points you in certain directions for this is the way that you should go. This is what, because for me, injustice pisses me off.
Yes.
Right? It completely acts me in a way that I want to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just realized that because we're all very different, you will feel deeply about an issue that somebody else doesn't really.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about you feeling deeply about an issue that you need to interrogate.
Because
you never know. You could be the spokesperson for that issue at some point.
Mm-hmm.
You could change lives because it's you resonate deeply from a soul level with that particular issue.
Yeah. And I think most of us have been taught to silence that and to silence our voices.
Yeah.
So what... And this project that we're doing is called 100 Voices for Change.
Mm-hmm.
Where is there, other than school, as you're growing, you said church, you were allowed to express your voice. But for many of us, church has been a place where our voices have been silenced in that space.
Yeah.
How did you navigate that? Or what was different about the space that you found yourself in that gave you voice?
Yeah, I think my voice started at home.
Mm.
It wasn't even in the church space initially. It was at home, and I lived in a space that was very... it wasn't the typical African home where you're just a child, you have nothing to offer, you have nothing to say.
Yes,
it was a space where we were all, you know, encouraged to speak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so even when my dad was called for this particular incident, he told the teacher off and said, but she was speaking, she was telling them, you know, and to date he speaks about that incident as well. Just like, how warped was that? That, you know, I was articulating myself and I was being shot down.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it began at the home front where you're enabled to speak your mind and to speak your truth.
Yeah.
And that gives you utter courage that you can't even possibly master in the outside space because you've been affirmed enough to know that, okay, you know, this pisses me off. This doesn't make me happy. I can actually articulate it and say it. And as a result, even now and with how I'm raising my kids, hopefully I'm doing a good job.
Yes.
But it's also just giving them, like, what are you feeling? Like, what are you currently feeling? Process the feeling and just allowing them to sort of like grow and to be vulnerable, which I think is really, really important.
So home is the first place.
Yeah,
for freedom.
For sure.
Yeah, for like even when we are
it
teaching.
It grounds you.
Yes.
It grounds you. It's a space of grounding. Mm-hmm. It's a space of anchoring.
Yeah.
So if that happens really well, you'll be a very solid human being if in my estimation. I'm not a psychologist or whatever.
Yes.
But that's my experience.
Yeah. And for people who've not had stable spaces to call home.
Yeah.
What are other places that you would feel would help with this grounding for freedom?
I think for me the church For sure. Because, mm-hmm. you know, the Bible talks about how we are all adopted in the kingdom of God and we are co-heirs mm-hmm. Alongside Jesus Christ mm-hmm. as brothers and sisters. And that mm-hmm. gives me a lot of hope knowing that even if your family of origin wasn't the space of solace and a haven of peace and mm-hmm. all of those amazing things, you can still get that in other spiritual spaces, like mm-hmm. in the church space, depending on where you go. That can still give you that thing that you missed when you were, you know, growing up. So it's okay. not all lost.
All right.
Yeah.
So we are speaking on feminism, and I'm glad that we've based that. We need to put this in homes mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. in our socialized spaces. Let's look at the work that you've done. Mm-hmm. Could you maybe give us a brief on like what some of the things that you've been able to do, but also because you've grown up in the church space mm-hmm. and also worked in the development sector, mm-hmm. there's a lot of patriarchy mm-hmm. and within those spaces, in my opinion. I don't know, maybe mm-hmm. it was all affirming in your space. How different, how did you experience or have you experienced the effects of patriarchy within the church setting, and have you experienced that mm-hmm. within the international, in the NGO, INGO mm-hmm. movement building work? How similar are they? How different are they?
Okay. Wow, that's a heavy question. First of all, I feel like the term patriarchy is very loaded. Mm-hmm. And as a communications specialist, I feel like it, like somebody will just log off this podcast when they hear that.
Yes.
So I don't want to use it because of that notion, mm-hmm. but I do want to give it the credit that it's due. Mm-hmm. So it is as strong as capitalism. Mm-hmm. Because capitalism is an economic system that the world runs in.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And it's very individualistic. It's very, it breeds a lot of inequalities. But for some reason, many of our country's economic setups are capitalistic structures, mm-hmm. right? That's the same way, I guess, patriarchy runs, where mm-hmm. it's embedded and entrenched yes. in ways of life, in culture, in how we move and how we interpret and how we process the world. Mm-hmm. So I'm not limiting myself to just the INGO or the work sector and the faith spaces, because it's everywhere,
yes.
right? And basically what we are saying is that it's the notion that one gender is greater and more significant than the other.
Yes.
And what makes it very pervasive is that not only is it the notion, mm-hmm. but you have the power to ensure that it is entrenched in different things. Mm. Mm-hmm. I was reading a really awesome book years ago called White Fragility.
Yes.
By a white woman, Robin DiAngelo, and she was just trying to sort of like break down race as a white woman, and she teaches folks on inclusion and racial justice and things like that. And she said something really powerful in the book, and she said that we are all biased. Mm. If you're a black person in the States, for example, you have a bias. If you're a white person, you have a bias. But what racism is when you have power behind the bias. Mm. So a person who is marginalized does not have power behind their bias.
Yes.
They will not ensure that you don't, that you miss school.
Yeah.
They will not ensure that you do not have economic opportunities, right? Mm. And it's the same way with how the world is structured from a gender perspective, where, you know, for the most part, women are denied opportunities that men can access. Mm-hmm. So you don't have menstrual products, so you don't go to school.
Yes.
So you then drop out. So then the poverty cycle is perpetuated. Mm-hmm. You undergo female genital mutilation, which is disastrous.
Yeah.
Right? Mm. You undergo child marriage. You're a 14-year-old married to a 60-year-old man. There's a power dynamic there that you can't possibly comprehend. And it's such a huge thing to grapple with. And we've got the gender wage gap, where a woman is paid less for a job that a man gets paid more. And so I'm trying to sort of like put a face to patriarchy. I'm trying to put examples, like how it actually looks like in the day-to-day type of thing.
Yeah, because many times I'm thinking that it's because it's a term and we use it.
Yeah.
Most times is like, I'm not a patriarch, or I don't espouse the values of patriarchy.
And I think because it's a very loaded word, like, unless you're like really like the KKK, you wouldn't come up and say I'm a racist, right? Mm-hmm. But you could be. You could be pseudo-racist.
Yes.
So it's the same thing. It's the same. I think patriarchy is such a loaded word. So I'd rather crystallize it a little bit and just flesh it out to just say, it's just basically living in a very unequal society where if you're of a certain gender, you just can't access certain opportunities and privileges that another can.
Yeah.
And the power that that does for you. You know, if somebody has such power, that they can limit your life and the potential of it, that's immense power that they have, right? So it's just seeing how do we sort of like structure the society in a way that people wielding the power have an appreciation of the power that they wield, but then also ensuring that other people are not left out.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a... It almost feels like it's an up in the clouds type of conversation to have, because we are really, really in the murky waters of inequality.
Yeah.
That it'll take, I see statistics of it'll take, I don't know how many years to get out of, to be an equal world. Mm. And it's like 200 years.
It's so far.
And because inequality is very, it's entrenched in very different spaces, you know? Mm. If you think about COVID pandemic, the people who faced the huge brunt of the pandemic were women.
Yeah.
Because economically, you know, obviously you don't have very many options. And then if you think about disasters, when a hurricane strikes, we know what's happening in Turkey. Women and children always face the brunt of that. So it's just, we just live in a very unequal society. And the systems and the structures that hold it together form further divides and cleavages that don't enable us to even address the inequality.
I'm thinking, as you're talking about that, about the with the inequality mapped up like that, what impact does spiritual authority, quote unquote, and financial authority in the workspace, how does that contribute to the inequality and the lack of freedom within these spaces?
I mean, the reality is that for most religious spaces, the purveyors of power are male.
Yes.
That's just a reality. And it's not just the Christian space. It's also, you know, other religions. And so there's almost a mirroring of the societal power in spiritual religious spaces. But I think it's a very heavily nuanced conversation. It's so much more than just that. So it's interrogating the spiritual spaces and saying, is there room for women's voices at a leadership point, at a congregational point? I know we've got many of our congregations, and I'm going to speak in this in the Christian space, are female. But it's not enough to just have them sitting in the pews if they can't also lead.
Yes.
And I feel that because of the diversity and the creativity that God employed when he created us, he created us very differently, and he created us with very unique sort of like perspectives and skills and things like that. And so at any point when you look around a room and you see some people are not represented in that room, you ask yourself, what are we missing?
Yeah.
So it's different. And I like the whole conversations of panels and just panels that are constituted in a very unequal way, because it's not so much that you want, we want equality, like one woman, two men kind of thing. It's just, what is it that they bring that is so unique and so peculiar to them that if you leave them out of this space, you're leaving a very crucial thing.
Yeah.
So for example, in the church space, if you are talking about a children's ministry or a marriage ministry that is skewed to one side in terms of gender, you're missing a perspective that's really valuable.
Yes.
You know, there's a way that I mother that my husband can never father in the way that I mother. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And so you need me and you need my eyes and you need my perspective to be able to speak into that space and to make it more enriching. I mean, again, it feels like a generalization, but I do feel like there are some churches that have made an incredible move to have that equality where partners lead. So it's both husbands and wives leading together.
But are they equal in power, or is the interrogating the
power structure is a thing for
yes.
sure.
Yes.
But it's much more than I have seen before.
Okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. There's a time you don't even know somebody's married until, I don't know, until they're introduced or something like that. So you don't see the woman or the wife at all in that space.
And also that's making an assumption that it is always the man
yes.
that becomes yes. the pastor and yes. never the woman.
Yes. Yeah. And we do have women pastors, and we yes. have very powerful, gifted women pastors as well. Mm-hmm. Definitely not as nowhere mm-hmm. as significant in number as we have men, but I think there has been some strides.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we've talked about the spiritual angle. What about in the employment space and the financial angle of it and patriarchy and navigating that?
Wow. I think in the workspace, it's more entrenched than we know and that we see.
Mm-hmm.
In the NGO development space, the spaces that I have been, we are not devoid of women.
Yes.
Like, because I think there's something about the NGO space, and it lends itself naturally to women's abilities and how they see the world.
Yeah.
But not many are at the top, right? So
yeah.
it's not so much how many women do you have in an organization as it is, do they hold the instruments of power? Can they sit around a table and make very critical decisions about policy directions and strategy and things like that that really push the needle on very critical thematic issues that we are facing as a country and as a continent, right? Mm-hmm. So there's that dynamic as well.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also this emerging dynamic of feminist leadership, which I'm really drawn to.
Yes, yeah.
I work in an organization that has two leaders, like co-executive directors, which I had never seen
mm-hmm.
before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's two very different people. Like, it's like night and day kind of people coming together and saying, we're going to lead together.
Mm.
And the premise and the spirit of it is that none of us are the be-all and end-all of all knowledge and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so bringing somebody in sort of like admits that you don't know everything, but
mm-hmm.
also brings a very different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen that in other spaces.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very anti-capitalist structure,
okay.
which I really like. Because capitalist structures are, it's one person at the top.
It's hierarchy.
It's very like hierarchical.
Very, who's the top of the food chain?
Yes, like exactly, yes.
And
what that does, and I wrote an article years ago about women cutting each other down and the proverbial corporate ladder.
Yeah.
And I feel, I really sympathize for women, especially like in the corporate spaces, because the truth is, there's only one ladder.
Yeah.
It's very hierarchical.
Yes.
I will cut you down to get to the top because it's a survival instinct. It's very instinctual.
And I think even, like sometimes we are told that women cut each other down, but we are never told about how men cut each other as on that other side of the ladder.
Yeah. And I think that if it's survival for the fittest and everybody wants to get to the top and resources are very scarce, you do what is best for you.
Yes.
So I completely get how you would see another woman as an opponent and try to cut her down because resources are scarce.
Mm-hmm.
We still have men being the captains of industry and holding the power.
Yeah.
And so if you have one woman, it's almost like, oh, I've made it.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully things are changing and now we could have a more flattened system of governance, which I don't know where we're at with that.
Yeah.
Because we're still supported by a lot of capitalistic structures that don't believe in a flat structure. So I think there's still so much to contend with, even in the donor space, and who gets the money. Who gets the money is very political.
Yes.
And how you do the donor reporting is also very political and very colonial.
Very.
Right? So, and this whole global north, global south binary really, I mean, it really irks me because I'm like, we're almost like entrenching what colonialists did by claiming that we're the global south.
Yeah.
And all the characteristics that are found in the global south.
Mm.
So I wonder if it's truly an empowering thing as we phrase it to be, or it's truly an entrenching of the systems and admitting, okay, we now have a global north. they are the rich people.
Yeah.
We have the global south. We are the ones who beg for money, like, yeah, type of thing.
Mm.
And I think there's power in language.
Mm-hmm.
So I avoid the global north, global south.
What do you use?
I don't know. I'm still yet to find something, yeah, to use.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it's almost like you need to play with the systems that be.
Yes.
Otherwise, you won't get any funding.
Mm.
Otherwise, you will not be employable.
Mm.
So it's almost like you just need to pay homage to the systems and sort of like figure yourself out. But internally, you're still grappling with, why are we the global south?
Yeah. And I think that's why I've seen a lot more of people diversifying funding, but also looking for, like, I've seen establishment of feminist funding, which doesn't need me to beg, doesn't need me to tell a sob story, doesn't need me to you know, raise you up to a level.
Yeah.
And
very dehumanizing in some ways.
It is.
Yeah.
I think after, I found that many times after writing some of these things, you just feel very deflated.
You do.
Because I keep saying, I need this money. There's so much work to be done.
Yeah.
But at the same time,
you're jumping hoops.
Yes.
You're jumping incredible hoops to get money.
Yeah.
And then you'll have to jump incredible hoops to report.
Yeah.
And then somebody will go through the document and fact check you and critique your English.
Mm.
It's really terrible.
Ooh, yeah. We'll learn. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think one of the amazing things, especially that I found with some, and not because this is funded by Voice, this recording, but I think having an equal table around and having conversations with some of these funders and some of these people as an equal, where you learn, you tell them this is working, this is not.
Yeah.
For me, I found this to be very refreshing.
Yeah.
That you can actually say, this, what you're doing here is not working. Please help us with this. This is better and all that.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, you're a writer.
Yeah.
You write for one of the dailies.
Yeah.
Do you still write?
I do. Yeah.
So I was looking through some of your work.
Yeah.
And there's an article you previously wrote that says, let me read, Christianity and feminism are actually not at cross purposes, but are indeed complementary.
Mm.
I am on a quest to interrogate the nexus between Christianity and feminism.
Mm.
What has been the most surprising thing you have discovered in this quest, both good and bad?
One, that Jesus was a feminist.
Mm-hmm.
I know people will, some people might not agree, but he really was a feminist.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as a Christian, emulating Jesus is what we're about.
Yeah.
I think I had not really... You know how you read the Bible and then really read the Bible? Like, I had not, like, really seen the extent to which he was a feminist. Mm. I think that he had male disciples because that was culturally appropriate.
Yes.
You're waking up really early in the morning. You're going, you're leaving home stretches at a time. I'm assuming that the women still had childcare responsibilities. So that wasn't, like, it wasn't a thing that would be very natural for them to do. So I feel that he had men as disciples because that was culturally appropriate. However, when I think of instances upon instances of him and how he moved this earth and how he interacted with women, I am so convinced that he is the person we should be emulating, that other, you know, men and women alike should be emulating.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about the adulterous woman who was brought and was just about to be stoned by all of these very self-righteous folks, and he looked at her with compassion. And I can imagine how, first of all, the law of the land at the time, the man that she was committing adultery was obviously not there because it was patriarchal. He had made his way out.
He could even be one of them with a stone.
Exactly. He could have been one of them because it was very, like, how dare you? You're a woman type of thing. And what was really incredible was just the mercy and the compassion that Jesus had. And when he said that, does any of you, if any of you has not sinned, like through the first stone.
Yeah.
And everybody just dropped their stone and walked off. And in my mind, and I'm going to read more commentary that goes deeper, in my mind, I actually think that he was speaking about the committing adultery, not just general sin, but committing. So you've done it, but you're looking at this woman with such disdain and disgust. Yet, you know, and Jesus told them, he showed them another way of life. He didn't condone the behavior, but he said, like, are you sin-free, right? And then when I look at other people, like you know, a prostitute washing his feet, him meeting the Samaritan woman at the well. And we, first of all, by virtue of culture, Jews and Samaritans did not engage. And then second of all, she's a woman.
Yeah.
And him asking for a drink. And she was so puzzled. She's even the one who pointed out, do you realize that I'm a Samaritan?
Yes.
Like, it's almost like, do you see the discrepancy? Do you see the binary?
Yeah.
Do you see the binary between the two of us and how you should not be talking to me? You cannot be asking water from me. And I feel like those instances that are scattered around the Bible just sort of like... And obviously when he resurrected and he came to women, the most witnesses.
The witness of a woman had to be verified by two or three other men.
They were not credible. They were not credible witnesses. Yet you went out of your way after the resurrection. And this was a huge, huge moment in history, in Christian history, to present yourself to women. And you
as
know
the first
as the first witnesses.
Yeah.
And I think for me that was a table turner. Like, it was a completely countercultural thing that he did. And one of the things that I noticed recently was in Ephesians, one of the Bible verses that pastors really like about wives submitting and husband, blah, blah, blah. And the context of that verse of husbands loving your wives as Christ did the church and wives submitting, and both of you submitting to each other.
It first starts with mutual submission.
Yes, it begins with mutual. That one is always left out.
It's never spoken.
That one is always left
never.
Out. But the thing about it is, I think we have a 21st century lens, so it's almost like, it's not very exciting. But when you think about Jesus who lived about 2,000 years ago, and you think about the cultural context.
Yeah.
So in that context, women, when you got married to a woman was a thing.
Mm.
A woman was a property. You would name your woman alongside the cows and the sheep and the goats that you had, right?
Yeah.
You would name her alongside the children that you had.
Mm-hmm.
That was the culture. And so even by God saying that husbands love your wives, it was almost like, what?
That's actually the scandal.
That is more of the scandal than the submission one, right?
The submission is...
It's not.
It's because it's actually landing from mutual submission.
Yes.
Which is also a scandal because why am I as a man submitting to a woman?
Yeah. And it doesn't matter if she's my wife. Like, she's one of my pieces of property. That is how the culture of the day was. And so what Paul was doing and what Jesus had done also is they elevated women to the point of equality. So I strongly believe that he was a feminist, and I think that the principles that he laid in the Bible are things that we should pay credence to and understand that that was the world. So that was a journey that I took with just realizing that the foundation that we sit on from a biblical point of view is actually a solid foundation enough for us to be equals, like women to be equals to men. And I think it's because of the brokenness and the systems and the structures that be that just continue to perpetuate the inequalities that women face today.
You know, it pays for women to be unequal. It makes more sense.
Yeah.
In the sense that you pay their labor less, in the sense you always have a punching bag, in the sense... So it is, in terms of how the world is structured, it pays for women to be subordinates. And so that's why feminism is also anti-capital, because it's calling for equal pay, equal time off and time at work, you know.
And now that you mentioned that, there's a statistic that I stumbled upon that talked about unpaid care work. And unpaid care work is a huge thing because it's saying that a woman will work during the day, for example, and then they will still go home and still do a lot of unpaid care work, whether it's caregiving of an elderly parent or a child or things like that. And the statistic said that unpaid care work was a number of times, I can't remember if it was 4 or 5 times, more than the value of the Silicon Valley in the States.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, and if you think about the magnitude and of the Silicon Valley and how much money is minted there, and it being an unpaid care work being several times more than that, you can understand, and it's what you're saying for, there's a benefit to women not being equal to men. There's a benefit that the capitalistic structures and systems get from that inequality.
I think capital needs free labor.
It does.
Underpaid labor.
I mean, if you think about colonialism, you know, if you think about colonialism, which was free labor, using African labor, using Latin American labor to build what is currently the United States of America and the UK, that was free labor. So you're years ahead of the African continent because of us.
Because you stole from us.
Because you stole from us. You stole our resources and our people.
Yeah.
And then you killed them and then you dehumanized them.
Yeah. So those are the good things. What are the bad things that you notice? Is there anything that was like...
So I did get feedback. I did get feedback. I don't normally leave my email address in articles that I write because I'm like, I'm afraid of people and what people will say. But I put my email address on this one. And there's a man who sent me an email that I've read over and over again. And he just said, it's very disparaging of me to compare feminism, which is a really dirty concept, to Christianity, which is a really pure concept.
Oh, Lord.
And I did I respond to him? I don't know. I'm not afraid of discourse.
Mm.
I think discourse is very healthy if you're willing to have it.
Yeah.
But I think I was in a busy season, so I don't think we continue to have that conversation.
Mm.
But I think it's a very unsettling notion to try and purport equality of feminism and Christianity. Because unlike every system that we have on the world, in the world, there are people who benefit from the system, knowingly or unknowingly.
Yeah.
And so trying to say that it's the same thing as something else is almost like cutting the privilege at the legs and them not accessing it. Because now you're saying, are you saying that Christianity and feminism can coexist?
Mm.
Not only am I saying that they can coexist,
mm-hmm.
I am saying that feminism is a principle.
Yes.
It's a Christian principle
mm.
that was embodied by God.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, and again, we talked about language. Language is powerful and language is political.
Yeah.
I think the same way I said that patriarchy is very loaded as a word. If you mention patriarchy in a room of men, they will run away.
Yes.
The same way it's very loaded, feminism is very loaded as well.
Mm. And Christianity as well.
They're all very loaded and very nuanced terms and phrases.
Mm.
And you need to sort of like sit in the discomfort of the word, sit in the discomfort of the nuances for you to understand and appreciate it in totality, right? To be honest, as a feminism, there are some brands of feminism that I don't resonate with.
Mm-hmm.
There are others that I do.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I resonate deeply with being a black feminist.
The womanist.
Yes.
Yes.
Because there's a way that I see life and I experience life as a black person that a white person will never experience.
Yes.
And so, and I think that's, I don't know, it almost feels like everything has layers and layers and layers that you need to dissect.
And nuances. And I think one of the things, what I'm loving about this conversation is that as feminists of all expressions, we need to be able to sit with nuance within the movement itself so that we look at what's our grounding values, what brings us together, what are those things that we can be allies together. Because I even said this in our previous recording, is that we have so much to gain by working together. But also, maybe we've touched on this, about the demonization of feminism in faith spaces.
Yeah.
But as a storyteller,
what
story do we need to tell so as to allow for allyship in these two very powerful movements? I think we've started talking about that. How can we tell the faith and feminism story better so that... Or is it better? I don't want to give a value to it, but is there space for allyship in this conversation?
Yeah. Wow. So I think, first of all, allyship is a little bit problematic to me.
Okay.
Because I've always constructed it in my mind as a very superficial interaction.
Oh, uh-huh.
Because I feel like an ally can be by your side, but will not be with you in the trenches. So I don't know if our goal is to get allyship than it is to just have sincere conversations about what the two represent. Right? I think the world, and I said this in that article, I think the world relishes binaries. If you're a feminist, you can't be a Christian. If you're a Muslim, you can't be a feminist.
Yes.
And there are many other kind of those binaries.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I feel that binaries can be very destructive, right? I feel like I'm a ball of contradiction. I am a creative, lawyer, intellectual. Like, I'm such a mixed thing. If you were to create me, if you were to put me in a binary, you would in a box, you would really struggle to find which box to put me in. And that's why I feel like trying to box issues doesn't always enable us to dissect them.
You know what boxing does? Yeah. It helps us control the narrative.
It does.
Yes.
It does.
Yes.
And it also makes it very static in a way. Like, in, you want it to make sense to you.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think both stories are important to tell.
Yes.
I'm actually writing a piece on women political participation, and I had to go way back to decades ago when women were not allowed to vote in very many countries, and just interrogating what that meant, suffrage rights and things like that, and how we've made some progress, but it's still very slow because we don't have as many women heads of state and things like that, say for positions that have been as a result of affirmative action or the quota system. But then I think that I really value the journey that the women's rights movement has gone through. Because when I was born, if I could vote at the age of one, I could.
Yes. Yeah.
And that was because a woman years ago, decades before I was born, marched and talked about it and lobbied about it for that to be able to be a reality for me, right? Mm. And so why would you as a Christian not resonate with that? Like, I think it's almost, let's interrogate, what is the discomfort?
Yeah.
Let's sit in the discomfort and say, what's so unsettling about it? For me, by the way, my definition of feminism is just equality of the sexes.
Yes.
Like, it's simple. Mm. It's not anything complex. It's just that simple. Mm-hmm. What makes you... Are you okay with a woman not being able to access menstrual products that in Kenya are still taxed as luxury items?
Yeah.
How does that sit with you? Mm. Right? Mm. So it's just those things. Like, it's just whittle things down to the bare minimum. Mm-hmm. And if you're not for this, if you're anti this thing, I would want to understand why.
Yeah.
And it's not a comfortable conversation to have, right? Mm. So I think it's moving from the abstract notions of feminism and what that means, because it's a very big word, as we said, to just the basic things.
The day-to-day of what making feminist choices look like.
Yes.
And then I look at the principles of feminism, and then I look at the fruits of the spirit. Mm-hmm. And I find that the two can work together so well.
Yeah.
And also what grounds me even is the fact that when God created us, it's like we were good. All of us were good. And we were full, we were whole, and we were equal.
Yeah.
Equal in power, in stature, in everything.
Yeah.
So that is one of the things that...
I mean, I'm also going to throw a spanner in the works and say that God is not male.
Yeah. Yes, definitely.
That God is not male or female.
Or female.
That God has both male and both female attributes, but that's so controversial.
Yeah.
That's such a controversial statement to make because I'm like, oh my gosh. And it's so funny because I was talking to somebody the other day and just saying how because of how we've been cultured, me in my mind, I think God is male.
Yeah.
Like when I read it, I feel like it's this guy, he's bearded, he's probably white or Middle Eastern type of thing. Like culture is that pervasive that even as you interrogate your own faith, culture just sort of like seeps through and you see God as male.
Yeah.
And God is neither male or female.
Yeah. But also let me tell you, I follow some Christina Cleveland and her illustration of the divine feminine and how also like the illustration, because you can say God the Father, but also God the Mother. For me, that just... Like the times, and I've said this, and the times when I pray about to Mother God, and those are illustrations that have been used in scripture, but they've been male. They've been, is it called melanized?
Something like that.
This is something like that. These times where God is talking about, like, as a hen gathers her chick, so will I gather Jerusalem under my, you know, that's a female attribute of God, but we choose to overlook that because it doesn't sit well with our faith and how it has been displayed.
Yeah.
This conversation is about the power of female voices, 100 voices of change, faith, freedom, and feminism. What would you say is the hindrance to access power for women in church, and what do we miss by silencing women?
I think we touched on this a little bit earlier. And perhaps, Carol, you need to, you know, interview like somebody in clergy or church. I mean, because in that space, that political church space, I think I said that because we are made in his likeness, but we are different.
Yes.
And we possess different skills and how we see life is different. If you do not have women in the church space as leaders, you miss something really critical. You miss something critical in their leadership style. You miss something critical in their outlook of life.
Yeah.
You miss ideas, you know. For example, I'm very aesthetic. I don't think every woman necessarily has to be very aesthetic. But there's a way I'm just like, no. Like, a space will be done up because I'm in that space.
Yes.
And somebody else will just, you know, a man, for example, will not see the value of that aesthetic thing, right? So I think that there's... looking at it from the point of view that they bring something really valuable. So the first thing is just knowing the value that they have and the value that they bring. And that valuable thing can be missed out if you don't have them in the room.
Yeah.
It's something that we need to be able to be really clear on. In terms of the politics and the church space and everything, as we said, like every other entity, whether it's the papacy or the clergy in this church or this other church council or elders or whatever, it's very political.
Yeah.
They're structured in political ways. And I guess that sort of like helps them function and helps them do their day-to-day. But I feel that women make really good leaders, even in the church space.
They do.
Even in the church space.
They do, yeah.
And I'm hoping that we could be honest and have honest, candid conversations about why they're missing. What is the church community missing as a result of them missing?
Yeah.
And what can we do to remedy this?
Yeah.
I think it's not something that'll take a year or two. It's going to take decades for the conversations to be had and for any reprieve or redress to be experienced. But it would be great to start having the conversations. It would be great to start having them.
Yeah. I think, though, I feel like when we miss out the women, it's like going on a journey and you have the capacity to take like two bags, but then you just take one. You know? You have the capacity to use your two hands. And I'm cognizant of the fact that there are people who do not have hands. Imagine if you had the hands. And you have the capacity to use the analogy. Two. But then you're like, nah, I'm just using one. This one is a weaker one. Let us hide it behind here. They will make us trip. They will, you know, how we are told we are Jezebels and all that. So I think, imagine not using 50% of your resources. It's latent. It's there. So... yeah, I think we need to, and this is why we are having this conversation, because many of these women are not using their power, their resources there. So is there anything that that has come up that you wanted to speak about that we've not touched on?
I mean, it's just saying that, one, the binary doesn't exist between faith and feminism. And even just human rights in general. I don't think we need to create that binary because it's not necessary. I think that the two can sit together and hold hands. And I feel like there's power when the two meet, because in many portions of the Bible, God was a God of justice. His heart was drawn to situations of injustice, and he did something about it. He was a really compassionate God. He still is... something was like, that was the past. He is a compassionate God, and we see that. And so justice and faith are completely intertwined. Like they meet at the hip, completely joined at the hip. And we need to see them as not two separate entities that we have been seeing. I think that having justice conversations in churches is important.
Yes.
Having peace and reconciliatory conversations in church is important. Addressing some of those issues that folks face on a day-to-day is important.
Yeah.
Because it's part of the faith.
Yeah.
It's part of the faith. And if we are mirroring Jesus and saying, what would Jesus do? Justice is part of it.
Yeah.
Justice and faith are completely intertwined.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. It was so good to have
you. You're welcome. Very
Asante
nice to be here.
Sana, Asante, and thank you also for being on our board.
Yay.
Thank you. So as you said, Msingi actually comes from Psalms 89:14. Justice and righteousness is the foundation of God's throne. And so we want more and more to have this justice conversations, because we have a lot of righteousness conversations, but what we don't have much of is the justice conversations. And so I hope that this conversation allows you to interrogate your biases more, interrogate the lies that you've been told, interrogate the loss that we have when 50% of us are not in leadership, are not giving our input in the faith spaces. And also interrogate the loss we have when women movements within church and women movements within activism don't gel, because we are all working for the freedom of humankind and the liberation of women. So thank you, and see you next time.